Now and then, one of the dusky forms, Americans, would stagger, reel, and crumple in a heap, struck by a flying bit of shrapnel or a shell fragment. Again, there would come a blinding flash and a terrific explosion. Four or five comrades disappeared. It was ugly, sickening, unnerving, but our training and our keying up overcame the nausea we could not help but feel. The only effect was a further tightening of the jaws. Private Ray Johnson, 145th Infantry, 37th Division, AEF, from his memoir titled Heaven, Hell, or Hoboken, on the Meuse-Argonne, September 1918. Hey folks, welcome to the Battles of the First World War podcast, episode 53, Meuse-Argonne, 26 September 1918, part 2, AEF 5th Corps. Let's kick it off with a couple of shout-outs and plugs, shall we? So first of all, much gratitude to new Patreon patrons, Nancy, Rachel, Pierre, and Gary. Thanks so much for your support. As patrons, you will have early access to all new episodes, as well as transcripts and bibliographies for those episodes. Patrons also have other perks, such as submitting a question that I'll research and answer to the best of my ability, and the possibility of naming a battle you'd like to hear covered on the show. If this sounds interesting to you, hey, check us out on Patreon.com/Battles of the First World War podcast. Patronage of the BFWWP can begin with as little as a dollar per episode, and it is greatly appreciated. And for patrons right now, if you haven't done so already, there is a supplemental episode up for you right now. It's on the Butte de Vaucouleurs. It's part travel history and narrative history, and I hope you enjoy it. Thanks again. All right, now for the plugs. Now, if you have ever wanted a guided battlefield tour through the areas where the American Expeditionary Force operated, then I have to recommend Mike Graham's of Normandy Battlefields and Valor Tours Limited. This year, Mike will be leading an 8-day tour of the American battlefields of World War I in September. That's September 2019. And if you are new to the subject or even a seasoned historian, his guided tours will immerse you in the history of the AEF. This year's journey with Valor Tours will meet in Paris, tour Belleau Wood and Chateau Thierry, and then spend time in the Meuse-Argonne region, touring the Verdun and Saint-Mihiel battlefields, as well as many of the battlefields that will be covered in the BFWWP's Meuse-Argonne podcasts. But it's not all battlefields and hiking. The first and last evening in Paris will be spent in the Golden Tulip Hotel at CDG Airport, and the evenings in between will be spent in the Hattonchâtel Château, an actual castle in the Wavre Plain that rates 4.5 out of 5 stars on TripAdvisor. Hattonchâtel Château and Hattonchâtel Village itself were restored post-war by the efforts of American philanthropist Miss Belle Skinner. The château and village are above Vigneulles, where the 1st Division met up with the 26th Yankee Division during the Saint-Mihiel operation. This is also the area where Sergeant Stubby fought. Rin-Tin-Tin was born in Rags, mascot dog of the 1st Division, also fought. And it's where America's first tank battle, led by Colonel Patton, happened. That's also where Patton ran out of gas in two World Wars. And it's where Alvin York first saw action in the trenches. You will see sights on these tours that you otherwise might have missed. Stops on this year's tour include the above-mentioned Belleau Wood and Chateau Thierry, but also several sites of the Verdun battlefield, including the main sites like the ossuary, but also lesser known ones like Fort Souville and the Citadel in Verdun Center. Daily excursions out to the Meuse-Argonne battlefields will have you stopping at the Butte Vaucouleurs, the American Montfaucon Monument, and the Meuse-Argonne Cemetery. Visits in the Saint-Mihiel area will have you walking in the streets of Seicheprey Village, as well as the Bois Brûlé Woods, places where American doughboys first learned what the World War was truly like. Mike brings his vast knowledge of the Verdun area and its history to his tours. To begin with, Mike was literally born in Verdun, France. While that usually might not sound like a guarantee of expertise, it is here, as Mike spent the first years of his life all the way to his teen years in Verdun. Mike also lived in Saint-Mihiel and Metz, too. Just awesome. He's remained connected to the area and makes frequent trips back, keeping his knowledge sharp. Contact information for Valor Tours and Normandy Battlefields will be provided in the episode description, as well as on the website and social media posts. It's like a lot of letters for me to say. You don't want me doing it. If you're thinking of a trip over there, consider an extremely knowledgeable tour guide to help take your trip from excellent to extraordinary. All right, so into the mud and muck of the 5th Corps trenches in the Meuse-Argonne, which was the center sector of the AEF's 1st Army Line. To requote from episode 51, quote, "In the center of the American attack front, 5th Corps, commanded by Major General George Cameron, was to seize the dominating Montfaucon along with other high ground on the Etzel-Giselher line. Cameron had 3 green divisions with which to carry out his mission. From left to right, they were the 91st, the 37th, and the 79th divisions. 5th Corps had the hardest job," end quote. They surely did. To also requote from episode 51, Montfaucon was, quote, "an 1,100-foot hill that dominates the area for kilometers around. Montfaucon means Falcon Hill in French, and a village had sat on that hill since the Middle Ages at least. In 1918, the ruins of medieval Montfaucon sat in a frozen agony, highlighted by the ruins of its ancient church. French artillery had long since decimated the village, and the Germans were using many of its structures, including the church, to house and hide observation posts. Montfaucon, where today stands a 180-foot-tall tower of breathtaking beauty with breathtaking views, would be a crucial objective to any advance from the current front lines. On Montfaucon's line of hills, the Germans had sighted and dug in their second position, 2 parallel lines of trench systems running through the Meuse Valley known as the Etzel-Giselher Stellung. This was a heavily defended line, and German soldiers were not to retreat from their positions," end quote. 5th Corps' 3 untested and untried divisions were assigned 1st Army's arguably most challenging task, the seizure of Montfaucon and other heights on the local Barrois Plateau. This was a clear sign that the AEF's command staff were still rookies in their respective field of work. But the situation was as it was, and let's see what these untested but eager doughboys would do that 26th day of September 1918. On 5th Corps' left was the 91st Division, nicknamed the Wild West Division, as its ranks came from the northwestern U.S., Washington, Oregon, Montana, Idaho, California, Wyoming, and Alaska. The 91st was staffed with the 361st, the 362nd, the 363rd, and the 364th Infantry Regiments, and was commanded by Major General William Johnston. The division had seen some halfway decent training back in Camp Lewis, Washington. These all-American boys had taken over the support trenches just days before the start of the offensive, and had been introduced to some intermittent enemy shelling and the near-constant threat of deep trench raids. Under strict orders from General Pershing and headquarters to maintain the maximum amount of battlefield secrecy, these German trench raids could become a problem if the Boche came in and captured a doughboy or two. That was the whole point of these raids. The 91st Division's mission that day was to clear out the shell-shattered Bois de Chappy directly ahead of them, and then continue pushing north to take the village of Epinonville and the ridge it sits on. This was an ambitious plan, especially for World War I, as Epinonville was 5 miles away and behind three German trench lines. The men of the Wild West's 181st Brigade would need to punch through the Southhagen, Northhagen, and the Völkerlein trenches just to get to the village. Then they would have to take and hold the village itself. Opposing these FNG doughboys were hardened veterans of the Prussian 1st Guards Regiment, part of the vaunted 1st Guards Division, with other veterans of the 117th Division to their left. Thanks to raids along the local front, the Germans went on alert on the 25th of September. Doughboys from the 4th Division further east had been captured in one of those trench raids, and they had talked. German commander General von Gallwitz now knew that the main American push would not be down south towards Metz and the Brie iron fields. It was coming on the Meuse-Argonne front. The morning of the 26th, as the American and French guns hammered the German defenses, the 91st took over the frontline trenches from the French 346th Infantry Regiment and packed the men of three regiments into the line. On the division's left, the 363rd Infantry Regiment would be shouldering against the 35th Division as it advanced, and in the middle would be the 361st. On the division's right, set to maintain contact with the 37th Buckeye Division, would be the 362nd Infantry. The 362nd by this time was commanded by Colonel John Henry Parker, whom we last saw in episode SA5 on the battle at Seicheprey, the episode titled Cherry Blossoms in Spring. Machine Gun Parker had just taken over the regiment less than 2 weeks before, described by a French officer as a, quote, gigantic Buffalo Bill, end quote. The tall and robust Parker brought a wealth of combat and command experience to this young regiment. As with other units along the line, many Americans were awed by the intensity of the bombardment that morning. Lieutenant Paul Hammond of the 362nd Infantry remarked, quote, "The horizon was rent by 1,000 flashes. The heavens seemed to open up. The earth under my feet trembled. Shells went tearing by the hundreds of express trains in a gigantic race," end quote. The same regiment's adjutant could only say, "So vast, so stunning, and the noise was so overwhelming." These accounts come to us thanks to Jeffrey Berkland's excellent history titled A Brilliant Operation, the 362nd Infantry Regiment in France and Belgium, 1917 through 1919. At 05:55 a.m., under the heavy fog thickened with an American barrage of smoke shells, the doughboys climbed up and out of their trenches. The men, loaded with ammunition, moved over no man's land and into the forest of tree stumps and burning trunks, while the machine gun and 37mm Puteau gun teams struggled to drag their weapons over the ground. A half mile into the woods, the advance teams came up against their first obstacle, and it's a story we've heard before. The artillery had failed to cut the German wire. There was, however, no resistance as of yet, so engineers came up and cut the wire open. The Wild West Doughboys made their way through the wire and were soon up against the Southhagen line of trenches. These fortifications had been utterly smashed by the barrage, and there were no living Germans in sight. The Allied guns had thoroughly done their job here, at least. The trenches, barely existed as anything more than smoking shell holes with debris scattered everywhere. The enemy had abandoned the field here. The tense Americans gripped their rifles tighter and continued moving north through the broken and murdered forest. Private Morris Martin, a runner of the 361st Infantry, remarked decades later on the state of the ground. Quote, "The ground was torn up and heaved into mounds. Trees were shattered and only stumps remained. Great shell holes yawned here and there, and occasionally a long concrete pillbox would be seen still standing. And entwined through all this debris were great quantities of tangled barbed wire which had been battered down by artillery fire. Our putties were soon torn to rags." Being in the last wave of the advance, we presently began to see results of our barrage. Fresh shell holes, still smoking, newly splintered trees, and occasionally a dead German, end quote. Up ahead, the artillery barrage was creeping forward, and it now worked the North Hagen Line trenches over. The doughboys, under command of their officers, took up defensive positions as they waited for the gunners to finish their work on this second line. The shells came smashing in from the sky, ripping out chunks of earth and trees up ahead. A mighty vengeance was being visited on the hated Boche. The guns lifted after a few minutes and started pounding new targets behind the North Hagen trenches. The doughboys of the 91st got back up off the wet and muddy ground and advanced into the dense wood of battered trees. The Germans hadn't yet answered. Had they finally gotten the message and given up? The answer, of course, is no. The Germans had pulled out of the first line to save their men and lure the novice Americans into the woods. They had then weathered the American creeping barrage on the second line by hunkering down in dugouts, and now they scrambled out of their dugouts to set up their machine guns. These Frontschwein were seasoned professionals at this type of work. As the Americans came up to their North Hagen wire and trenches, they came upon low ground in the form of a ravine. It was here that the Germans opened up and let the doughboys have it. Bullets tore through the air as the hammering of the German machine gunner exploded in everyone's eardrums. Doughboys caught by the surprise fire jerked and danced as if they were macabre marionettes, rifles falling to the ground. Those with split-second reflexes fell to the ground. Within seconds, the stark and brutal reality of veteran German troops against the green doughboys was vividly displayed. The German machine gunners worked over the doughboys, tearing into their ranks. The Americans scrambled for cover as bullets punched into their bodies and blood spurted and gushed into the contested soil of France. The doughboys were caught in terrible ground, and it now fell to survival instincts. As German bullets ripped the trees and fellow soldiers all around them, some men began to fire back. Some fired wild, just aiming in the general direction of the enemy, but others, like Private First Class Karl Meyer, advanced through the ruined forest as calmly and safely as they could. Meyer himself crept up close to a German machine gun team and fired three well-aimed shots. Each one killed an enemy soldier. With that team out, Meyer's platoon broke into the North Hagen trench line. A bit further away, Supply Sergeant Harold Anthony shot and killed an entire four-man machine gun team, and he then took the captured machine gun with him as he continued to advance. It was a chaotic response, but the battered Americans broke into the German lines. It took 37mm gun teams blasting away at the enemy, and a group of doughboys on the right breaking protocol and maneuvering from the adjacent 37th Division sector to outflank the enemy and begin rolling up the line. On the 91st Division's left, the 363rd Infantry took fire from the Butte de Vauquois, which was in the neighboring 35th Division's area. In the fog and chaos of being shot at, they strayed into the 35th sector and wound up assisting the Missouri-Kansas men in taking the ruins of Verrey and clearing the flank there. On the 91st Division's right, a dangerous gap was growing between the 362nd Infantry and the 37th Division. The latter unit wasn't keeping up with the advance, and as a result, the 91st's right flank was dangerously open. If the Germans knew of that gap, they could rush men into it, attack from the rear, and undo what advance there had been so far. Colonel Parker of the 362nd was particularly worried about this. With the second trench line taken, and with orders from Pershing himself to keep advancing no matter what, Parker's men pushed on through towards the third enemy position. The Americans continued advancing north over rolling farm fields that offered little cover. The 362nd Infantry was now moving towards the Fulker trench system on its own, as the 361st on their left had fallen back, and the 37th Division on the right was now way behind. Harassing machine gun and artillery fire was coming in as they pushed forward with completely exposed flanks. As the Americans came to the crest of a low ridge, machine gun fire began to light them up. The fire was coming from the Fulker trenches up ahead, below the ridgetop village of Epinonville, and it was also coming from the village of Ivoiry to the northeast. The infantry broke into small groups under fire and began using whatever cover was available. Riflemen paused to take shots at the enemy, laying down covering fire as machine gun and Puteaux cannon teams set themselves up. Once these were set up, they began to send their own streams of fire back at the Germans, as other infantry teams kept moving closer and closer to the enemy trenches. Rifle grenades sailed toward the Germans once the range was right. Artillery couldn't be called in. Communications with the rear was intermittent at best, and the range of the guns had already been passed. This was all the same, as behind the American lines, an already massive traffic jam was steadily growing and growing, and the division's artillery was stuck in it at the moment. So it would be up to the infantry to work with what they had. They did. Colonel Parker himself was in the attack, making a show of his own fearlessness. As he came up to one company commander, he asked if his men were scared to advance. Lieutenant Paul Hammond thought Parker a reckless ass for acting like this, but it was likely the regimental commander was trying to put on a brave face for his men. Increased fire from American Puteaux gun teams forced the Germans to keep their heads down, and this gave a chance for a company of doughboys to run through a ravine and thus threaten the Germans from the rear. The Boche knew when to quit now, and they now pulled back to the southern slope of the Epinonville Ridge to regroup. It was mid to late afternoon now, and Epinonville was just a half mile away. The 361st Infantry came online with the 362nd. Colonel Parker and a Captain Bradbury, one of Parker's company commanders, decided an attack on the village was worth the risk. As the tired doughboys rose once more, they were greeted by machine gun fire from the south side of the ruined village. By 6:30 p.m., though, Americans of Companies C and D, 362nd Infantry, were in the streets, battling Germans house to house. In the confusion and rush of combat, men from the 361st started to intermix with Parker's men in the vicinity of the village. Command and control became that much harder. Epinonville is a typically small village in the Meuse region, with a main east-west road that connects to Ecclefontaine to the west and Ivoiry to the east. Each of these villages is about a kilometer away. In Epinonville's center is a church. During the war, the church's steeple and roof had either been removed beforehand or blown away by the artillery. The houses were fairly well shot up at this point. C and D companies pushed their way north, through the houses, and on out of the village. Behind them, A and B companies now came into the village, clearing out the houses and cellars that might remain occupied. The situation was tense and confused as men from the 361st continued to be around the village. Towards dusk, the advance north of Epinonville stopped. Artillery was called for but denied. Guns had finally been put in place in the nearby Bois de Verrie, but as the gunners couldn't get exact locations on friendly units, fire missions were denied. With this information in hand, Colonel Parker had his men pull back to south of Epinonville to occupy the Fulker Line trenches. This was a clear position recognized on all American maps, of which there weren't that many. Thus stopped the 91st Division's advance that first day of the offensive. The Wild West boys had taken some 500 casualties during the day, but they had advanced over 8 kilometers and broken through 3 German trench lines. It was one of the AEF's most successful drives that 26th day of September. Colonel Parker and his men would be alert all night as their right flank still lay open. The neighboring 37th Division hadn't been able to match the 91st advance. In the center of 5th Corps was the 37th Division, nicknamed the Buckeye Division as its units came from Ohio. Originally an Ohio National Guard unit, the 37th had been federalized for the war. The Buckeye Division's objectives that day were to clear out the Bois de Montfaucon directly ahead of them and then make for the village of Ivoiry, which sits on the same ridge that Epinonville sits on. This was to help the neighboring 79th Division's push on Montfaucon itself. Once Ivoiry was taken, the 37th was to keep pushing north to just under a kilometer away from the village of Sierre-sous-Montfaucon, where it would create a line running from the Bois de Aimont to the Bois de Bourges. A push through Sierre and on further north was to bring them to Romagne-sous-Montfaucon by the end of that first day. With the lifting of the guns into the creeping barrage that morning of the 26th, the 37th Division attacked out of the pounded ruins of Avocourt Village, with 2 regiments abreast, the 147th Infantry on the left and the 145th Infantry on the right. The heavy fog kept the doughboys obscured from the Germans, but as the fresh-faced Americans stepped forward through the muddy and half-collapsed trenches, belts of abandoned barbed wire, old shell holes, and wild brush, they found why the enemy had been so quiet. Private Ray Johnson of the 145th Infantry, who's quote opened this episode, saw with his buddies that the German first line was quote literally pulverized. Everywhere, on every side, nothing but yawning shell craters, cluttered with broken timbers, twisted bars of steel from dugout roofs, broken rifles, torn German packs, and all sorts of debris. It gave the impression that a gigantic series of dynamite charges had been exploded simultaneously and had turned the whole terrain upside down, end quote. The men continued on through the fog, rifles at the ready, with bayonets flashing dully in the mist. The Buckeyes pushed forward 3 kilometers until they reached the Ravin de l'Effouan, a ravine that bisected the Bois de Montfaucon running east-west. Inside the wood, this was a 50-meter-wide strip of cleared ground with a stream in it. Behind it lay trenches of the German Hagen line. It was when the doughboys stepped into this strip that the Germans opened up on them, cutting the first ranks to pieces. Unfortunately for the Germans, they were undermanned, and the Americans crossed the shell-shattered and now swamped ravine to get into their trenches. The ensuing fight saw the Americans take no prisoners. With the Bois de Montfaucon cleared, the 147th kept pushing on towards Ivoiry as it tried to link up with the 91st Division on its left flank. The Buckeyes were unable to take Ivoiry, digging in well south of it. On the left, they knew they were not linked up with the 91st Division, but they advanced no further that day. On the division's right, the stalled push by the adjacent 79th Division held up the advance here. The men of the 145th Infantry then pushed out patrols to connect with men of the 79th. Some of these patrols, in the confusion of dust, actually made it all the way to the top of Montfaucon Hill itself before they realized the hilltop was crawling with Germans. The patrols came back down and joined the others in digging in for the night. The 37th Division had managed a 5-kilometer advance, but the confused and unstable conditions around the imposing Montfaucon had stopped them in their tracks. And on AEF 5th Corps' right was the 79th Division, which of all the American divisions had the hardest job that day, taking down the German bastion on Montfaucon. As we discussed previously, the defenses on and around Montfaucon were no light matter, and a veteran division would be hard-pressed to do what was being asked of the 79th. It remains a rather stunning decision that AEF Commander General Blackjack Pershing and 5th Corps Commander Major General George Cameron would choose this division to take that hill. In August of 1917, the 79th Division was raised at the then Camp Meade in Maryland, and its ranks were filled with men from Maryland, the Washington, D.C. area, and Pennsylvania. The division had trained itself, as did other divisions of the forming American Expeditionary Force. That is to say, training generally left a lot to be desired. But in July of 1918, as the 79th made itself ready to depart for France, the powers that were in the Army stripped 15,000 trained men from the division and shipped them to France as replacements for losses. 15,000 new men entered the division's ranks, men from Ohio, West Virginia, and Rhode Island. These men were as eager as any other American to get over and do his bit, but they were all raw recruits. The 79th shipped off to war essentially untrained. They were led by Major General Joseph Kuhn, a sharp-looking officer and a West Point graduate who was known as a strict disciplinarian who loved him some marching. Major General Kuhn, though a career soldier, had no combat experience, and it was the same with the majority of his officers. Reporters referred to the 79th as Kuhn's singing army in their dispatches back home. It would soon be known as the Lorraine Division, as it would adopt the Cross of Lorraine as its identifying symbol. Kuhn organized his division to attack in brigades in column formation, meaning he would be attacking with one infantry brigade across his front, with his second brigade following 1,000 meters behind the first. Within the brigade, two infantry regiments would be advancing side by side. This maneuver was a difficult one for green units like the 79th, but there was no more time for training. Once the men started moving, and the bullets and shells started flying, it would be tough to control the advance. To further confuse the situation and make it more difficult, the 79th Division's right flank was 5th Corps' right side boundary. To the right of 5th Corps was 3rd Corps, led by a Major General Robert L. Bullard. Bullard had the veteran 4th Division on his left, and it was 4th Division that would assist the 79th in the taking of Montfaucon. So the key objective in the day's offensive lay bisected by corps boundaries, which was bound to make communication that much more difficult. Then came the perceptions and the lack of communication between the commanders. Major General Kuhn told his field commanders that the 4th Division would be assisting by coming into the 79th's divisional sector to attack the German second position. To his right, however, 4th Division Commander Major General John L. Hines told his men that while they would indeed be assisting the 79th in the, quote, reduction of Montfaucon, but only within our own area, end quote. Both corps and both divisions had received the same orders from Pershing, yet both divisions had come away with different interpretations. Neither division nor corps commanders checked with their peers to ensure everyone was on the same page. The 79th faced Montfaucon itself, which sat overlooking the coming battlefield some 3 miles away. The division's objectives for the first day were to take the Bois de Malancourt and the ruins of Malancourt village just ahead of them, then Montfaucon, then the village of Nantua further north, all while maintaining contact with the 37th Division on the left and the 4th Division on the right. Supporting the 79th attack would be several companies of French tanks, mostly the Renault FT-17 baby tanks, but a bunch of the heavy Saint-Chamonds as well. To maintain secrecy, the 79th only took over the trenches at Avocourt the night before the attack. They relieved the African-American 371st Infantry Regiment, then under French command, as the guns pounded the German lines. In Jean Fax's book, With Their Bare Hands, there is an especially well-written recollection of that bombardment that is just too good not to share here. Private Leo Jax of the 119th Field Artillery wrote later, quote, "The deep, muffled booming of the howitzers sounded like thunder coming out of a cyclops cave. Waves of sound seemed as material as waves of water. We were engulfed in them. They surged and washed and echoed from crest to crest in volcanic tones. The great forged steel bolts passed with a rushing noise like a huge wind. Trees along the slopes of our hills bent heavily, with their branches waving and shaking, and their heads bowing as if a tornado were blowing above them. And little ripples ran along the grass tops as volley after volley raged past." End quote. I hope Private Jax became a writer after the war because, man, he had talent and an eye for the world around him. On the front line, the doughboys of the 79th readied themselves as the last minutes of the barrage smashed up the German first line. The noise was indescribable, and for many of these new and barely trained riflemen, the concussions and shell bursts must have pounded their ears and made it impossible to speak or even think. Last-minute ammunition checks were made, and grenades were now distributed. The Allied guns lifted, signaling the beginning of the creeping barrage and that it was time to go over the top. And it was at this time that the German guns in this sector, quiet until now, began to speak. The Germans were no fools. They knew the beginning of the rolling barrage meant the infantry attack was coming, and that meant that the enemy's forward trenches would be packed with infantry. In the heavy fog of that morning, with shells impacting amongst them, the soldiers of the 79th advanced out into no man's land. The division pushed out with the 313th Infantry Regiment on the left and the 314th Infantry Regiment on the right. With the rain from the previous night, the shattered battlefield was a muddy swamp, and every shell hole was a potential death trap. The rough going and heavy fog instantly wrecked unit cohesion. Soldiers became separated from their squads, platoons, and companies. Those who stayed together bunched together in groups. Luckily, the fog was heavy, and the Germans couldn't really see them. Also, there weren't that many Germans to begin with, at least not in the first line. Any Germans who survived the initial bombardment now followed their instructions: fire a few bursts, and then melt away to the second line further back. A few machine gun teams and snipers kept up a harassing fire that set the raw troops of the 79th on edge. Corporal Oskar Lubchansky of Company G, 313th Infantry, and author Jean Fax's maternal grandfather, wrote later, quote, "I have a hazy recollection of a hazy march, a cold night in a trench, an ear-splitting artillery barrage. Our company was in reserve, our duties calling on us to mop up and clean out machine gun nests that our other waves had passed up. I can tell you it was some sensation. We had the whole of Malincourt Woods to traverse. Our artillery had torn everything to pieces, but the inevitable snipers and machine gun rats still remained. As I said, it is some sensation to hear a rifle crack and a bullet whiz past your ear and you not knowing where it comes from." End quote. The Lorraine Division doughboys pushed past the shattered enemy trenches and on into the Bois de Malincourt. The men didn't get far into the bomb-blasted and naked tree trunks before German machine guns opened up on them. The air suddenly exploded with the hammering of the enemy's guns and the buzzing of a million murderous bees cutting through the air. The Americans hit the ground as quickly as they could and began to fire back at any enemy within range with rifles and grenades. American boys crumpled under heavy fire until German men jerked and then slumped in their own shell holes. German snipers hiding up in trees took out several doughboys until fusillades brought them crashing down. In the morning fog, the confusion continued. After narrowly avoiding death from an enemy machine gun team just a few feet away from him, Lieutenant Miller Johnson took stock of his 50-man infantry platoon. He had 10 men left. Yes, a few killed or wounded, but the majority lost in the fog. Johnson took what was currently left of his platoon and kept pushing north. Behind the 313th, the men of the 316th Infantry started to merge into the mess. Having waited until 0700 to go over the top, the men of the 316th wanted in on the action. They charged forward and began intermingling with the men of the 313th. Here was another communication and leadership failure, unfortunately. These men wanted in on the action and were only dimly aware of their job. They were to clear the Bois de Maulincourt and then secure the advancing infantry's rear. Their lack of understanding could have explained the fire they were now taking from groups of Germans who had been bypassed in the woods. Behind the 316th, men of the 311th Machine Gun Battalion struggled mightily to drag their machine guns through the shell-shattered ground, and they were falling way behind the advance. Men grouped together out of a need for security, comfort, and to know they weren't alone in this terrifying hellscape. They stepped on towards the objective, wherever that was. Out of the fog, rattles of gunfire and the blasts of grenades. Bullets thwacked out of nowhere, but into somewhere, tree trunks or men's bodies. There were screams in the fog, sweat and ragged breath, and overhead, the train-like rush of shells rushing towards German lines. On the 79th's right, the 314th Infantry, under Colonel William Ury, had farmland to advance over. Overall, the 314th was able to keep more of its subordinate companies and platoons together, but they fell behind the artillery timetable, just like the 313th on their left. These men pushed into and past the brick piles that had been Aucourt and Maulincourt villages. In their haste and in the fog, they didn't realize they swept by many Germans in the ruins, and these men just stayed put. Back on the left, around 9 a.m., the ragged remnants of the 313th Infantry, with Regimental Commander Colonel Claude Sweezy leading, reached the northern edge of the Bois de Maulincourt. Ahead of them lay the Gulf de Maulincourt. The Gulf de Maulincourt is a triangular patch of cleared farmland about a kilometer and a half wide and about a kilometer long. Halfway across this open ground was a German trench line protected with thick belts of barbed wire. At the northern end of this open field was the Bois de Cuisy, where more German machine guns were hidden in the woods. Sweezy's 2,000-man regiment was down to 300 men, mainly due to losing men in the fog. He couldn't wait for them to catch up. He ordered his men to attack across the open field. And so began heavy combat. The Germans unleashed a hellstorm of machine gun fire as soon as they had the doughboys all out in the open. Americans went down by the dozen, some screaming. Others killed instantly without another sound coming from them. Anyone who could survive the first initial burst went to ground, but officers repeatedly regrouped their men into frontal attacks on the German trench line. Within short order, one battalion commander had been killed, and a second had his legs shredded by bullets. An infantry team decided to skirt to the left and come at one machine gun nest from 37th Division sector. 22 Germans were captured in this daring attack, but the enemy line remained firmly closed off. Sweezy sent a telephone message back to his brigade commander. Request that tanks be sent forward. I am suffering severe losses from machine gun fire, apparently from southeast of Montfaucon. We have no artillery barrage. Then he and his men went to ground, and they stayed there. Anyone who showed his head or any movement attracted the German machine guns. The 313th was stopped cold, and now men of the 316th came crashing into the scene, attracting more fire. It was quickly becoming chaos, and a French liaison officer later said the division was not a body of troops, but a mob. On their right, the 314th had pushed past the ruins of Malancourt when the fog cleared out around 11 a.m., and that was when machine guns opened up on these men from nearly every direction but from above. The Germans missed or left behind in Malancourt could suddenly see, and they turned their guns everywhere. Here, too, chaos threatened, but the 314th kept it together better. One group of doughboys found themselves right next to a German machine gun nest. Before the gunner could swing on them, one of the Americans lobbed a grenade into the enemy position. The grenade exploded but didn't kill the men, who promptly surrendered. The German prisoners were then forced to point out their comrades' positions. The ruins of Malancourt became a hotspot as American troops worked to clear out any Germans they could find. An American squad, led by a Sergeant John McCauley, attacked a group of three enemy machine gun teams. The Germans were taken out, but McCauley's squad had attracted other German teams, which then killed McCauley and took out most of his men. However, this allowed other American squads to move in and attack these surviving teams. As the battle for Malancourt raged, the 315th Infantry slammed into the 314th from behind. Despite this confusion of command, Malancourt was cleared, and Colonel Ory pushed his men to advance before things got beyond his control. By noon, though, machine gun fire from up ahead had stopped his regiment's advance just a half mile north of the ruins of the village. Now both the 313th on the left and the 314th on the right were stopped. Tanks or artillery were needed. There would be no artillery. The guns attached to the 79th Division were caught in the massive traffic jam behind Evercourt, and there was simply no way to get them out. The traffic jam also ensured that wounded men would wait days, literally days, to be evacuated, and many would tragically die before they could be properly treated. As for the tanks, a French army company of Renault FT-17s officially attached to the 37th Division was found nearby, currently unemployed, and willing to assist the infantry in its next fight. They rumbled and squealed their way up to the northern edge of the Bois de Malancourt, where Colonel Sweezy and the remnants of his regiment lay on the ground trying to avoid being killed. Having thought he would get no help from either artillery or tanks, Colonel Sweezy had just had his men launch an attack across the Gulf de Malancourt at 2 p.m. They'd been slaughtered for no gain, as they couldn't get through the wire running across the middle of the field. Sweezy had lost many of his officers by this point, making command of his men very difficult. When the Renault tanks showed up, a new attack was planned. There are differing accounts of the attack on the Gulf de Malancourt and the seizure of the Bois de Cuisy beyond it. Jean Fax provides both the 79th Divisional History account, as well as an account by Colonel D.D. Pullen. Colonel Pullen was an American engineer who was himself attached to the French tank company that day. And although Mr. Fax cautions that Pullen's testimony may be a bit exaggerated, it still makes for great reading and a probable recounting of the afternoon's events. So, from the book, With Their Bare Hands, here is Colonel Pullen's account of the second attack by the 313th Infantry on the afternoon of the 26th. Quote, "When we reached the point A, about halfway up the Gulf de Malancourt, at the wire obstacle, we found the leading infantry brigade was held up by a few snipers and one machine gun in the Bois de Cuisy. The French refused to advance any further, as they said that their orders were to proceed through the Bois de Cuisy and not take part in any fighting until after the infantry had taken the Bois de Cuisy. The infantry apparently was very disorganized, as they made no attempt to go forward. After conferring with the French, I requested them to fill their gas tanks and be ready to fight. They did this, but refused to proceed further without written orders from the brigade commander. As the brigade commander could not be found, I finally got hold of Captain Gaetan Liara of the 13th Battalion. Upon being asked whether he would fight or not without written orders from the brigade commander, his answer was, "I do not need any written orders. I will fight anybody at any time." Lieutenants Ellis and Saint-Cély had gone ahead and located the resistance. Captain Liara was given the information as to the direction of the resistance, and he deployed his five tanks, the only ones he had available. Personally, took command of the five, accompanied by Lieutenant Ellis, and walked on foot and took his tanks up to the edge of the Bois de Cuisy and drove the Germans out of the edge of the woods. He then entered the Bois de Cuisy with his five tanks, lost two of them in large shell holes, proceeded with the other three with Lieutenant Ellis and a few engineers, and surrounded seven Germans who had been holding the edge of the woods. Captain Liara killed two Germans. The tanks killed one, and the others were taken prisoners by Lieutenant Ellis and the captain. As soon as the infantry saw the five tanks enter the woods, the whole brigade came up out of the trenches and entered Bois de Cuisy. No infantry commander could be found, so all the troops were gathered together and instructions were given to form skirmish lines on both sides of the road marked in red. After the infantry were deployed and ready, the three remaining tanks advanced straight up the road with the infantry on either flank. The far edge of the woods was reached, and no further resistance was encountered until we started out of the woods. We halted at the edge of the woods, sent back for more infantry, got them in the north edge of the woods in Bois de Cuisy. End quote. This was effectively as far as the 313th would go that day. The 314th to the right was stuck a half mile north of Melancourt. Throughout the day, Allied pilots had been reporting that they saw Americans in Montfaucon or beyond it. Many officers in the field, those still alive anyway, had few ideas on where they actually were, and even fewer maps on hand. Allied observation balloons had been shot down by the Germans and thus couldn't report at all. Fifth Corps kept receiving reports that units were in Nantes or near it, and thus well past Montfaucon. When the reality of the situation was discovered, General John Blackjack Pershing was furious and telephoned to let everyone know that the 79th was holding up the entire First Army's attack. This is another place where the lack of planning and training was now in plain sight. 5th Corps Commander Major General Kamen tried to contact 79th Division Commander Major General Kuhn. Cameron couldn't get through. Kuhn himself furiously tried to contact his units, but he had no communication with his brigade commanders. One brigade commander was in the field and completely out of contact for hours when he decided to move his command post. So Major General Kuhn, the division commander, had no contact with his ground units. And Colonel Sweezy and Uri had no communication with their division commander. The signalman trying to lay wire over the artillery-plowed battlefield were using cotton-insulated telephone cable. In the rain-sodden earth, this wire quickly short-circuited and became useless. Rubber-insulated wire, the better choice, wasn't available. No one had practiced or trained for this. There had been no time. They would have to learn now and quickly, while bullets were thudding around everybody. Pershing could yell and demand all he wanted, but the 79th wasn't going much further that day. By evening, the soldiers of the 79th had been in combat for over 12 hours, and they were exhausted. Everywhere along the line, from the men of the 91st, just below Epinonville, to the 37th Division boys near Ivoiry and beyond, the American troops settled in for a cold and hungry night. Most had left their coats and packs behind the jump-off trenches, as they had been ordered to do so. Bringing up hot chow was near impossible, and not really being thought about anyway. We will stop here for this episode. The story of the 79th will continue as the battle for Montfaucon is just beginning. The 37th will be a part of that story, and the 91st Division has its own tale to tell. So, how had 5th Corps fared? The 91st Division had advanced some 8 kilometers and had ruptured at least 3 German trench lines, the South and North Hagen lines, and the Fulker line. The 37th Division had much more uneven results, with a push of 5 kilometers into enemy-held territory. Around the western slopes of Montfaucon, the advance was much smaller. The 79th Division had hit a wall southeast of Montfaucon, taking heavy casualties at the Golfe de Maulincourt and the ruins of the village itself. To their right, the presence of the 4th Division up beyond the village of Setsarge, directly east of Montfaucon, had the German position on the blasted hill on very shaky ground. As for the Germans, they were overall reeling from the day's events. Reserves in the area immediately behind the front were heading towards the front already. The German 37th Division, just to confuse things a bit more with all these numbers, and the 5th Bavarian Reserve Division were on the march. Incidentally, the 5th Bavarian Division was camped around the village of Fontaine, which is one of my favorite places on this good earth. As we know, this thing is just getting started. We will be back just as soon as possible with the next report on the AEF's 3rd Corps and operations on the right bank of the Meuse with the French 17th Corps. Questions, comments, or concerns, please don't hesitate to contact me at verdunpodcast@gmail.com. I love getting emails from listeners. Or get at me on the Twitter at WW1podcast. Check out the BFWWP website, FirstWorldWarPodcast.com, for some photos. And check out the Battles of the First World War podcast page on the Facebook. Thank you so much for listening. Talk to you again soon. Take care.
Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of 3 and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals, and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.